afternoon. The panel, RNZ National, Wallace Chapp with you. Regarding checks, ID was not needed in banks, as staff knew almost all customers and were likely to be familiar with families too. This was when there were New Zealand banks and staff were not required to hard sell of unwanted and very lucrative products. Ka kete, says Anna Lee. So thank you for that. That was a very interesting comment there. A study shows that reading before sleep extends your life. Fiction even more so than non-fiction. That's interesting. I've never heard that. We might have to sort of do something on that later on. Anyway, with us is Moata Tamaira, Digital Library Web Content Lead at Christchurch City Libraries, and Ben Thomas, the Public Relations Consultant. First of this, the news that New Zealand is temporarily suspending travellers from India, travel into New Zealand from India, including for New Zealand citizens and residents, is, as we know, being temporarily suspended because of high numbers of COVID-19 cases. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said yesterday, that's from the 11th to the 28th of April, India is experiencing a major surge in COVID-19 cases with nearly 100,000 new infections imported every day. Reported. And this is reflected in the cases picked up in managed isolation here, with 80% of the past 2 weeks from the subcontinent. With us to talk around the legalities of it is Al Gillespie, who is Professor of International Law at Waikato University. Al, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace.
So I understand it is the first time New Zealand has stopped citizens or residents from returning. Is it legal? Is it contrary to any law?
Well, previously we've stopped foreign people coming into the country, but to do it now to say that Kiwis can't come home, even on a temporary basis, this is a unique time. Big question, is it legal? Yes, it's legal, but it's important that it's temporary, that it's reasonable, it's proportionate, and it's consistent, and we treat all countries the same.
Reasonable, proportion, and consistent, and the fact that it's temporary, and as you say, other countries to be treated the same as well, that's key, is it?
So we'll have to work out, I mean, there's clearly a risk with this pipeline of people coming in. And so we have to make sure, though, that we treat not just people coming from India, but whether they come from England or America or South America, all exactly the same. And so in 2 weeks' time, hopefully we'll see the workings for how that decision is made.
Bit of a change of tact, isn't it? Minister Hipkins saying, quote, it's a little bit of a change of position. We've always said that we wouldn't stop citizens and residents from coming home. We are not, but we've also said that their travel may be delayed or disrupted. Do you think it's a fair call?
I think it's a big change because ultimately you want to make sure that this is the last resort to actually stop people coming back. So you'd have to make sure that there's no other reasonable alternative to let them in and to be safe. And to say that they're actually going to stop it would suggest that there's no other alternative at the moment.
Moata, what do you make of this issue? It's certainly hard on those who are perhaps, as we might say, stuck there, albeit temporarily.
Yeah, it's a big call. Mm. And the Prime Minister has been pretty consistent about saying that she didn't want to be in a position of saying that New Zealanders couldn't come back to New Zealand. And I don't think that she was being insincere then. I think that is something that they've been wanting to keep in place because you don't want to be in that situation where you're saying, no, you can't come back. But I can understand why people have questions about why this is happening now, what are the different things that have come into play that have made this be a decision in this instance now? I've seen people being quite upset about it, and I can kind of understand why. I mean, if we had a situation where New Zealand governments had never made decisions about who could come into our country based on race, then I'd feel a lot better about it. So I think it really behooves our current government to be as transparent and as clear as they can be about what the justifications are and why they're being applied in this way now.
Al, what do you make of those comments?
Yeah.
I think we have to be very careful here, not just with regard to domestically, but also internationally, because the international community does not like these kind of restrictions, because the fear is if New Zealand does, we won't let certain people in from a certain country, others may follow it, and there's no international basis to do that. So there's a risk of precedent forming and other countries being excluded.
Ben Thomas, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't think that race or the fact that it's India is the driving is the momentum behind this decision.
It has been mentioned quite a bit on social media, hasn't it?
Yeah, look, it's clearly being driven by concern about the numbers and particularly the rate, I think, as Michael Baker said. You know, the percentage of people turning up from that destination who are COVID positive, and the fear, presumably, that you know, adds to the chances of getting COVID into the community here or overwhelming MIQ. What I would say is I think you would have to be pretty naive to think that the fact that it's India rather than the UK or the United States didn't make this an easier decision for the government. You know, if you look around social media, comments under, you know, news websites and stories about this, you'll see the most appalling racism. You know, and there are other options to look at. You know, one of the ones that has been mooted is an MIQ facility in India for people before they depart. Because the other thing is, look, in terms of reasonableness, which is what any kind of infringement on rights will come down to, as Elle said, you need to look at, well, what are we trying to do as well? If the goal of managed isolation and border controls and letting New Zealanders back in is only to let in people who don't have COVID and to keep New Zealand completely COVID safe, then you'd say, well, any restriction's justifiable. But if the reason is actually to let New Zealanders back into New Zealand and do that in as safe a way as possible, then you might extend more leeway and you might say, well, actually managed isolation is here to catch the people with COVID before they get into the community, and that's what it's for. And so having COVID is not is not necessarily a reason, or the possibility that you might contract COVID on your way here is not enough of a reason to turn people back.
So just summing up there, Al, it's not a breach of, the government's ban does not breach the Bill of Rights Act.
Not at the moment, no. But it has to be shown to be proportionate. It must be temporary, and we must make sure that we're consistent in the way that all peoples in all countries are treated. And the big step now will be what happens in 2 weeks, whether this will be continued or whether we're going to start to see a new pathway into something else like vaccine passports.
All right. Professor Al Gillespie, who specialises in international law at Waikato University, thank you very much for your time. It is 15 minutes past four. You're on the panel, RNZ National. This morning, thousands of school students and other supporters took to the streets in the country's main cities to call for action against climate change by taking part in the school strike for climate. Strikers were calling on the government to begin a just transition into a sustainable future and to recognise the impact climate change will have on our Pacific neighbours. In Wellington, the crowd converged at Parliament for speeches and for the demands to be handed over to the government. And Izzy Cook is one of the organisers of the Wellington protests. She's with us now. Izzy, kia ora.
Hello.
So happy with the outcome? Turnout?
Definitely. Yeah, it was a great turnout today. It was great to see everyone coming down.
Let's just remind ourselves or make it clear for our listeners just what the school strike for climate is asking for.
So this strike, we had six key demands that we were striking for. So basically those demands were prohibiting fossil fuels nationwide, investing in a renewable energy, investing in a just transition, reducing agricultural emissions, and investing in some climate education.
You might have to sort of turn your head or turn your body just a little bit, Izzy, because you're really breaking up there on your cell phone. And are you getting a lot of support from those? I mean, how many others outside the school sphere, other than students, turned up? Was there an age range of protesters?
Obviously, there was a lot of school students, but we also saw a lot of adults and a lot of other people, which is great to see.
Yeah, I really we sort of can't really quite hear you there, Izzy. So you might just have to sort of walk. This is great about cell phones, isn't it? Walk about 3 feet in one direction. What's can you sort of give us a general mood among people of your age? I mean, do you believe that the government is going to take the action it needs to, or not?
Well, I think definitely we're all hoping that the action gets taken, and it does get taken as up to what will happen now.
Mm. All right, so Ben Thomas, what's your take on the school strike for climate? A good thing?
You know, good on a number of levels. One, climate change is probably going to kill us all in the not too distant future.
Okay, so that's a fair point.
Probably good to raise awareness of that. Two, always nice to see young people out taking a stand, being interested in issues. I mean, the youth of today, you know, because of factors like the internet, because of, you know, the oncoming end of the world, much, much more informed and less ignorant than I was at that age. Where it's a bit stymied is, you know, they don't actually have a lot of leverage, right? So when they strike, they, you know, it's a great show of, you know, support for the issue, and it may build a constituency for political parties. It may show the big parties, Labour and National, who are the ones you really need on board for this sort of thing, that actually this is what their voters are concerned about. If they want 18-year-old voters, they need to, you know, be a bit more active on climate issues. But it is hard to get, you know, specific change, you know, done through these mechanisms.
Right. So what do you make of that? As you've been saying, basically it's all for nothing.
That's not quite what
well,
I said.
Yes, it was, wasn't it? Is he?
I mean, yeah, it is true that since we're only striking school, it doesn't have as much of an impact as it could. But what I think what we're kind of trying to say is not so much that we're striking school because we are trying to, I don't, maybe punish the government. We're just trying to show them that the school is important to us, education is important to us, but also having action around climate change is really important to us. So it's more a show of how we feel really strongly that we want action.
All right. Moata, what are your thoughts?
Well, I acknowledge what Ben said there. I think he's made some fair points. But I think we've got to take into account, like, this is just one thing. I remember having a conversation with somebody one time. Okay, yes, it was a taxi driver. And he was like, oh, I don't know about all this banning plastic straws. What's the point? What's the point of banning plastic straws? It's just like one little thing. But the thing is, like, we started with the plastic straws and then, you know, and we moved on to the plastic bags. And then all of a sudden you find yourself thinking about all the other ways that you can do a similar thing. You know, like, you get rid of the straws and you realise, oh, that wasn't so bad. So I think that this can, you know, if you're starting to grow a movement, you've got to start somewhere. And I think, you know, starting with the strikes is, you know, not a bad place to start from.
And you'd support that, Izzy, of course?
Yeah, well, definitely individual action leads to systemic action. So the founder of our movement, Greta Thunberg, she was just one person that would sit on Parliament steps demanding change from her government, and now we've got a massive movement. So I definitely agree that it's all about that first steps being taken.
I just want to bring up what Ben was saying in terms of that hard to translate into political action. Wouldn't the ultimate goal here is to translate this groundswell of young generational support into votes? Should we be lowering the voting age to 16 so many of those people that were striking today, they'll go out and they'll vote? What do you reckon?
Well, I'm not sure School Strike Climate has any opinions on this, but personally I definitely believe that we should lower the voting age as it helps young people have much more of a voice in political issues.
That would be the answer, wouldn't it, Ben? Make the voting age 16.
I'm actually not a fan of lowering the voting age, but
why not?
But just to because I think that you should have a checkbook before you vote. no, but look, at the same time, I think the school strike for climate is fantastic, you know, because, you know, teenagers don't have a lot of political power, like you've just said, and and any way that they can make their voices heard. And, you know, this is a pretty emphatic way of getting your voices heard, right? Mm. These are huge crowds.
Yeah.
You know, if you have to go back to things like the foreshore and seabed hickoi or genetic engineering to see similarly sized crowds in Auckland or Wellington. The fact that this is basically organised by high school kids is incredible to me. And the most important thing is it keeps it on the agenda. You know,
right.
Look, I used to work in Parliament, right? And I became very despairing about the climate after I left Parliament because I sort of thought, well, you know, somebody will be taking care of it in the background. But, you know, I knew when you're in Parliament, you only care about, you know, you're like, well, what's on the below the fold on the front page of the Dominion Post today? You know, everything seems very urgent and necessary, and it's usually not right. Things like how do we reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, which, of course, is much more important than whatever the issue about MP office rent of the day is. So it's really important, and it's very admirable, that, you know, at least the high school kids are keeping this on the agenda and in the news.
Mm. Very nice to have you on the program, Izzy. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
That is Izzy Cook, one of the organisers of the Wellington protest. Just on a final note, Moata, what are your thoughts? I mean, Ben is against having giving young people a voice.
I think you've mischaracterised that just a little bit, Mayor Wallace.
Right, yeah, I know, I'm just teasing him. He doesn't want to lower the voting age to 16. What about you?
I honestly have never thought about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of like, I don't know. Like, if somebody make it a members' bill, and let's just like
we'll park that
check it
panel.
Out. Let's just talk about it. Let's just nut it out and figure out if it's a thing that we want to do.
All right.
I'm not 100% against it, but I also kind of don't know.
4:25 the panel. There's a big change hitting iPhones within weeks. Apple says it's close to going live with a new system that'll let you stop apps tracking your online and real-life activity without your permission. The opposition from Facebook and Google has been fierce, writes Chris Keel in the New Zealand Herald. So the Apple operating system for iPhones and iPads within weeks has a new app tracking transparency feature, the ATT, requiring apps to ask your permission if they want to track your data across apps or websites owned by other companies. Now, that information is often used to target ads or sold to data brokers. With us to discuss is Privacy Commissioner John Edwards. John, kia ora. Welcome to the program.
Kia ora, Wallace.
So you think this is a big deal. In fact, you called it, quote, one of the defining moments in the digital age.
Yeah, I think it is a really big deal. It's Apple, which has a really significant proportion of the mobile phone market and which acts as a gatekeeper for apps, is requiring a level of transparency that we haven't seen. And it's really putting a stake in the ground and saying, you know, Apple is a brand that values privacy. And if you want to have privacy, you'll get it with our products and our services. So it will be interesting to see how the market reacts to that.
Yes, well, Facebook, Google, not happy. Facebook estimated to lose $8 billion in 12 months. Google, $17 billion due to apps having to ask your permission. They say it'll hinder small businesses' ability to deliver personalised ads.
Yeah, the Harvard Business Review has cast a bit of shade on those estimates of loss. But I'm really surprised at the outcry from Facebook and Google. Well, I mean, not in one sense, but certainly in the sense that it's a real vote of no confidence in their ability to sell their business model to their customers. They are saying, if we ask people to do what we do with their data, they won't let us. So, you know, so that transparency is fatal to their business, is what they're saying.
Moana, what do you think? This idea of now you'll have to opt in if you want to have an app track you. What do you reckon?
I mean, I'm for it, but also there's a very cynical part of me that's just looking at these tech giants and fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. and it's a little bit, you know, there was a really terrible movie called Alien vs. Predator, and the tagline of that film was, "Whoever wins, we lose." And I kind of feel like, you know, you're talking about multi, you know, national corporations who have got their fingers in multiple pies, and, you know, I think it's a bit rich for iPhone to come across as being morally superior here.
John,
I don't think they have a leg to stand on, really.
Fair point.
I love that Alien versus Predator comparison.
You can use that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it says you can use it, so go ahead.
I mean, the cynics would say that Apple is not primarily a data business. It's a device business. They want to sell more units, whereas Facebook and Google, they, you know, their development costs, their research and their innovation is all funded through the revenue that they generate from you know, not being open and clear with users about how they're using their data. But, you know, let's come back to that point about the cost. I mean, Facebook made $90 billion profit last year. They are saying, you know, their worst-case scenario is that being honest with people and giving people some autonomy over how their information is used to track them for ads will cost them $9 billion. So, you know, a 10% haircut by giving consumers more control. That doesn't seem unreasonable to me.
Right. Ben?
Yeah, but John, I mean, obviously you'll appreciate, you know, first it's losing $8 billion by being more transparent, then you lose another $5 billion by banning Nazis, and it all starts to add up. I mean, look, John's right. It's, you know, because with an iPhone, you know, you're paying up front, you know, about $1,000 or $2,000 or God, whatever, if you're buying it new. And you know, so they've already got the money from you. They're not interested in sort of letting the other large firms harvest your data and sell that on, whereas that is an integral part of Google and Facebook's business model. At the same time, they are very important for setting standards across the industry. You know, Apple in the past has faced down Uber about privacy issues and threatened to remove them from the App Store, which, you know, again, even though iPhones are not the major part of the smartphone market, it's enough and they're influential enough that would have been a huge blow to Uber, and so they had to be more respectful of privacy.
Just on a very final note, John, just so in a nutshell, in a few weeks' time, we will be asked if we want to opt in if an app would like to track us. Is that right?
That's my understanding. And that means that those offering those services have to be pretty clear and clever about the value proposition. Many of us probably will still want to see and, you know, to get information about things that we're interested in, and, you know, but we'll have better information to make informed choices about that.
Very, very interesting. Privacy Commissioner John Edwards, thank you very much for that. You worried about apps tracking your? I mean, it can be quite unnerving, can't it? When personalised ads come to you, you feel like you've only been thinking about something, Ben, and next minute something pops up about curtains or pot plants.
I've been reading an interesting book called The Twittering Machine, which is actually named after a painting rather than just Twitter, which talks about these sorts of things. And, you know, the big issue is not that people are selling my data about my commercial or consumer preferences, because I don't really care about that. But what's more interesting is that, you know, the way that these platforms are actually set up to keep you coming back, like you were talking about with the gamification, with the notifications, what they're actually doing is they're making you work by essentially all the time that you're scrolling and clicking and pointing, you're basically just doing market research for them, for the audience of you. You know, and then you can't help but feel a little bit exploited.
Ben Thomas and Moata Tomaida with me on the panel this afternoon, Friday's panel, 28 to 5. It's time for headlines.